Hey, before we get into the episode, this is my last reminder that Starting Small Summit is next week. We're flying in some amazing founders, and we just added Devin Klein, the founder of Burn Bootcamp, to come to South Bend, Indiana for a live event. Registration is free at ideaweek.com. Check it out in the link in this description and come back to the episode. Hello, and thank you for tuning in to Starting Small, a podcast about brand development, entrepreneurship, and innovation in the modern world. In this episode, I'm joined by VidYouth of Entropy, scalable AI-powered solutions for product verification anytime, anywhere. At the palm of your hand in seconds, Entropy protects businesses, buyers, and sellers from transacting in counterfeit and fraudulent items. Hello, and thank you for tuning in to Starting Small. Today, I'm joined by VidYouth of Entropy. VidYouth, thank you so much for joining me today.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so I'd like to start out with your upbringing. Where did you grow up, and what would you say your childhood was like?
Sounds like I'm talking to my therapist. But let me start with this. I was born in a small farming town in India. That's where I did most of my growing up. I was educated there in Bangalore. I was born on a farm, then we moved to the city by the time I was old enough for school. So my super, super young years were on a farm with a lot of animals. And then we moved to the closest city called Bangalore, where my dad had a government job. So grew up very utterly Indian middle class, which is very different from American middle class, but, you know, financially all the same. We also happened to, because we were middle class, we also happened to grow up around counterfeits. So, for example, I'd go to school and the school would, you know, my folks always insisted on education being important, which is sort of a tradition and a trend in India, more so than other cultures. And as part of that, they enrolled me in a really good school. And in the school, they would give you these school issued shoes of, you know, roughly $25, which is kind of expensive if you think about it. So my mom would be pretty paranoid. It's like, hey, you're a kid. You're probably going to run around and, you know, roll around in muck and ruin the shoes in a few months. And the school year is a long, you know, nine months at least. So she would go get me a pavement coffee of $2 worth of shoes. So that's what you would wear 4 out of 5 days. So in a way, you know, we kind of grew up around counterfeit products. It was always normal. I even would buy pirated CDs and counterfeit goods, you know, as I was just getting into high school because it was normal.
Yeah.
But I finished high school and I started studying journalism. So I'm not an engineer by education. I'm a journalist by education. And I was a journalist by trade too for a very short while. I was in a couple of small newspapers. I made some films, short films with some friends who fortunately have gone on to have or are currently having great movie careers. But I switched pretty quickly. And got into the corporate world, working in marketing communications, public relations, sales and business development. Also, while in college, I was part of a small startup where we were the first ever South Asian video game developers. So that was fun because it was an interesting period because it was all of us really young people in college trying to build something which we thought was really cool, but not really understanding the approach or the way to go about it. So in many ways, it was finishing school for learning how to build.
For sure.
Lots of mistakes then. Thankfully, they weren't as expensive as mistakes, but you know, I'm glad I went through that experience.
Totally. Yeah, when you went into communications and kind of sales and marketing background, what were your aspirations at this time, post-graduation? What did you want to do? What did you end up doing as well, graduation?
I haven't had a job interview in over 13, 14 years. So maybe by now I should be okay with sharing it. But I honestly never wanted a job. Mm-hmm. I never wanted a certain job or a career because I didn't really believe in it. Weirdly enough, until I met my co-founders in 2011-ish, when we met and we started talking about different problem sets and what can we do just as a thought experiment, right? It really, something woke up in me where it just clicked in my head and I said, this is what I want to be doing. And at that point, I was also switching careers. I was working for a company which makes TurboTax. Okay. And it wasn't a job that I had a lot of passion for, even though it was going well and then wasn't, and then going well and wasn't. And I realized that I wanted a change where I could really put my passion to use, which was actually in sports marketing. So I was going to be working with a very famous sports person and managing their contracts at that point. So right at that juncture, I had to make a choice between working with my co-founders and building Entropy or, you know, doing that other job. Mm. But what I do feel, and I feel this even today, fortunately, is I feel like what we do, there's a reason for it to exist. It's unfortunate, but it needs to exist.
Yeah.
And it needs to be as impactful as possible with more and more scale.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, kind of paint that picture, a longer journey from India and then coming to the States. Like, what was that transition like? And what was the reason in coming back? Yeah. Was it a job? What did that look like?
Yeah, so I used to travel to the US a lot, but mainly to the West Coast to work with these other companies. And I never really had the ambition of living and working out of here, but I always knew somewhere in the back of my mind that I'm going to see the world. I'm going to hopefully do something that is useful to people, not any scale as such. I never dreamt of, hey, we need to do this and this, these billions and these millions, et cetera. Those were never part of my ambition. Yeah. But when we decided to build Entropy, we went through a process of, hey, this is a problem set we want to tackle. And it feels like we should exhaust all of these, you know, run through the list of all the possible viabilities for what we're thinking of building, sort of like figuring out product market fit, but in the most basic level, not really at a scale level. So we actually, without even realizing it, we're applying the lean startup methodology, which is a school of how do you go about building, you know, the building process. It so happened that there were some verticals and industries where we realized that there is a problem associated with trust, which needed technology to overcome it. And some of them were based in the US, and also some of them were based specifically in New York. And so I just picked up my bags and moved here. Yeah. And it was a very spur of the moment decision. And that was it.
Yeah.
And it was driven by, hey, this is what we need to figure out. Let's just do it. So we were very biased towards action in the early days than, you know, planning and prepping for a long time.
Mm-hmm. For sure. So Entropy comes around 2011, but what is the genesis behind the founding? So Counterfeit Products, you guys utilize AI. What did the prototyping process look like from the start? I'm curious.
So as I mentioned, we were validating the importance of just using any technology. And at that point, my CTO, our CTO and co-founder, Ashlesh, he was working as part of his PhD on some basic experiments on this concept called fingerprinting. Fingerprinting is the ability to say that if humans have fingerprints, what if objects also have fingerprints? And if they actually do, which objects have them? And if all of that is true, then where is it useful, right? Mm-hmm. So the idea of validating that technology against market problems across different markets, like art is the most obvious thing you think of when you think about fakes, right? Counterfeit is different as a connotation compared to fakes.
Yep.
We started with the connotation of fakes, art, money, currency, agriculture, food, pharmaceuticals, art, and then a lot of industrial goods. So way down that list was luxury products, because we didn't see that market to be as big or as, you know, it wasn't as, basically it was a massive ocean. It's a $3-4 trillion problem as it is, counterfeiting as a whole. And then you can find your own niche within it and it'll still be a fantastic place to be.
Yeah.
So it took us a while to digest that, went through the list. And then when we got to luxury, the The process always involved going out into the market, talking to people, understanding what their problems are, not really telling them, asking them, hey, is this going to work for you? It was more about being very open and starting from complete scratch. Because remember, none of us as founders, none of us were insiders in any of these markets. So we didn't even have a place to start. So we had relied on our network. We relied on friends and family and colleagues and business contacts, and then just random cold outreaches saying, hey, I'm thinking of this. Can we just have a chat over a coffee or a drink or something like that?
Yep.
So we did a lot of that. And the first conversation we had with a luxury company, it was interesting. So we even spoke to the brands, and the brands were like, that's the obvious thing you'd think of, right? They're the manufacturers. You go and work with them.
Yep.
They said, this is amazing. Whatever you're thinking of doing, fingerprinting or anything else, but come back when you have more data. So we had a cold start problem, right? So what we did then was we went down the line, we went to retailers, we went to resellers, and we realized that resale has a huge issue around trust, because there is no regulation, nobody's helping them out. How do you know if something you're buying online is A, the same thing that is that you're claiming to buy, and two, if it's actually legitimate? It's a very basic question. Then we realized when we spoke to offline stores like pawn shops, consignment stores, just offline people, they said the same thing. They said, well, they don't know and they don't need to know. I'm like, are you sure they don't need to know? So we asked consumers, and 100% of consumers said, oh, yeah, if there was some way to tell, 100% I will use it. I'm like, interesting. Then we went to a reseller and we just showed them like paper diagrams of what we were looking to build. Which was an authentication service, right? And the first conversation we had, they said, in after 45 minutes, they're like, hey, why don't you guys build this for us? We'll acquihire your team, basically pay me and my co-founder a good chunk of money and just work for them. Just because we had a paper presentation.
Yeah.
So that gave us enough validation. In the early stages, that was good aha. As good as an aha moment to spur us on to go further, deeper into the market. Then we raised a small pot of money and we said, this is what we're going to be doing. And we made our first hire. And soon at that point, we realized that what the market wanted was an immediate on-demand way of knowing if something is real or not.
Yep.
And that was the genesis of building Entropy and the certification engine.
Love it. So from that founding and the prototyping at that stage at launch, does that look the same as today? Was it still so a user could take a phone with camera? How did that scanning and verifying process look from launch?
Yeah, it was very obtuse. I think that would be a good way to describe it. It was very dinky, the device we had. We had a probably a 6-inch high device with, you know, it was like this thick. It was fairly sizable, and it wasn't really wieldy. It was kind of unwieldy as a thing to use. And the way it would work is you connect that to power. It has a Wi-Fi chip that turns on, and that remotely connects to a phone. And you can actually look at the phone and run the device on the surface of something, right?
I see.
So very non-user friendly. but somehow people were so kind to us. And this is why we always stress on being good to our customers, because they were there when we started this. Of course, there was a value proposition, all of that, but they were kind to give us that time, which business allows you to do that? So we signed up about 60, 70 customers very early on when we were doing a beta, and we tested this every day, wanted them to just use it, tell us how it worked, etc. And despite all of these annoyances of this unwieldiness, they still used it. They still loved it. And there was a point, so this was the second aha that we had, where we said, okay, we would have a couple of months of beta, but then I was not comfortable with running a business where it was just given away for free.
Yeah.
We needed to understand what is the monetary value for something like this. So we initially charged customers $1 for every time they authenticated, right? And at that point, there wasn't even a certificate. It would just say yes or no, real or fake, right? And then we realized that the consumers were asking, what are you doing? You know, what is this? Because they were using it almost as a gimmick to convince consumers that, look, this is legit. It's not me saying it. It's this app and this technology saying it.
Yeah.
And at that point, we were like, interesting. So this should actually be you should have a certificate as an output at the end. It wasn't really an aha at that point. But it was like, okay, product feature, right?
Yeah.
Then subsequently from $1, we moved the price. And this was the other thing. We were still following a little bit of an analytical process where I was like, okay, so we told them it's $1 and they didn't blink.
Yeah.
What if we told them it's 10 bucks, increase the price 10x and see what that limit is, right? Where people are going to just yell at you and just stop using it. Turns out even at 10, they were like, okay, I don't want to use it. Cancel this service. We're like, okay, fine. We're not going to do it. This was on a Friday. I remember that very clearly. This was on a Friday, and about 80% of those 80-ish customers were like, not worth it. They stopped. So that weekend was a very interesting weekend to go through because, you know, the anxiety of, oh shit, these are your only bread and butter and you've alienated them. Well done, right? But Monday morning arrives and, you know, we go back into our email and we log in and there are like 30 different emails saying, hey, where are you guys? I know I said we don't want this. Can you turn it back on again? They didn't even realize we hadn't turned it off.
Mm.
In their mind, it was like, hey, these guys can turn it on and off anytime they want. So they had emailed us. We said, oh, you can still use it. And by the end of that day, about 85% of those 80 customers came back. Because they said that I have a customer in my shop. I need to get this activated now. We said, yeah, feel free to use it. And you know the deal. It's 10 bucks a pop. It also helped us understand why that price was okay. It also helped us just think back. It was obviously in hindsight, but basically most people, especially the businesses that we work with, they're totally okay with having something priced at somewhere between 1% and 3% of what they're transacting in, one. And two, they're used to that because they used to charge back insurance.
Yeah.
Yep. And we, in a way, work like insurance. Right? Because we're protecting them from, it also helped us learn the value prop.
Totally.
We knew that we're protecting them from downside. They don't have to take in a fake and lose all the money. So we help them save money. We help them save time because they don't have to take in a product and break their heads on, okay, what is this? What brand is it? How much is it going to sell for? Blah, blah, blah. So we help them save time. And with the certification, they actually include the cost of that within the selling price of the product.
Mm.
So it's an absolute no loss product for them, but 100% upside.
Yeah.
So we help them save time, save money, make more money. And that told us, okay, now we understand that this is the value we're providing them.
Yeah.
So I think that was a big aha for us in
for
differentiating
sure.
between what are we selling to people versus what is the value they're actually deriving.
I hope you guys are enjoying this episode so far around Vidyut's entrepreneurial journey. I'd like to pause and say thank you to this episode's mid-break sponsor, Blomis, where intelligent, minimalist, and functional design meet to elevate your contemporary home. Since 1961, Blomis has been a beacon of exceptional quality and craftsmanship rooted in the German tradition. With a firm belief in honesty of materials and purity of shape, Blomis brings your interior design and accessories made to last for generations. From the humble beginnings as a bicycle part manufacturer, Blomis has evolved into a visionary design company offering gifts and design items crafted from copper, brass, pewter, and stainless steel. For myself, I'm a huge fan of their outdoor products. I'm personally drawn to their outdoor torches for lighting up my backyard with a very simplistic and modern look. I highly recommend to check them out and make sure to go to blomis.us. That's blomis.us and enjoy the rest of the episode. At the back end, like the interface, how does this look where the product, especially when you guys had the physical hardware at that time, but how does that look where the interface knows what product they're scanning and it knows what to allude to for a real product of whatever they're scanning?
Yeah. So that is really the big competitive advantage in the moat, right? So even before we started, the first hire we ever made was a data collector, right? So when we got these offers to, hey, why don't you work with us or work with this other company and build it for us? We realized at that point that data was going to be super, super important to build what we were doing. And it's an even harder problem to kind of a harder initial obstacle. It's not even an obstacle. It's a massive wall, right? It's a wall of ice that we had to break through. But even if you made a small hole and got to the other side, you can then slowly expand on it. So we realize that it is going to take time and it's step by step. So our first hire was a data collector, and we started building databases, which is completely proprietary, of visual images of physical products. But we collected that ourselves. So we needed to know what fakes looked like. We needed to know what authentic product looked like. So we actually went sourcing around the world, and we still have a data and a knowledge team which does this every day. We source from all over the world, and it started really, really small with just me going out and going to a retail store and going to the handbag section or the watch section, and people were okay with seeing a guy at a watch section, but they were like, what is this guy doing in the handbag section? This doesn't compute. So the sales associates would come to me and try to, they thought I was trying to steal stuff. So it was fascinating, interesting experience, but that's kind of how we started building data. And that data is what we use to train algos to understand the minutia. We also teach them the minutia where they don't get it.
Yeah.
So that's how the algo constantly improves. And that's the benefit of AI, right? We started doing this AI stuff when it wasn't sexy at all.
Yeah.
Like 2015. So now we've scaled to a point where that data makes such a huge difference. We have samples from like 1940s all the way up to now. So it's pretty comprehensive. And in the back end, that's how it works. You collect data, you ingest it, understand it, train the algos to understand it, and then test the algos. And you keep testing it until you iron out all the wrinkles, like some things which it didn't detect or we didn't know about. It'll automatically throw them up as results. And when you review them, you're like, this shouldn't be here. So keep refining it, get it to a point where it's deployable, deploy, and then it's automated.
Amazing. I mean, with the problem you guys are solving here, if you can kind of allude to, like, how serious is the counterfeit industry today? Like, especially, I mean, in the industry for many years now, you guys have been 2011, but like, not only just false advertisements killing manufacturers, but like the toxins they put out and everything else. I would love to have you touch on that.
Yeah, to be honest, you know, when we got in, we kept looking at this from the manufacturer standpoint, because they were going to be the ones we thought who were going to pay us the most. I mean, we do have those relationships, but generally speaking, our biggest, you know, we have about somewhere between 6,000 and 7,000 different points of distribution globally at this point, where we have devices or apps running, et cetera. And it's all only businesses of various types, including manufacturers. Now, with time, what I've come to realize is the biggest impact that counterfeits have are on two different points. One is a local society, or a national or a local society, and second are consumers. So consumers are the most heavily impacted, because consumers are actually impacted directly in a health hazard way. So what happens is people buy fakes because they think, oh, it's only 20% of the original, right? And it looks pretty damn good, especially nowadays that fakes have gotten so good that you know, a lot of people actually, in a perverse way, actually like buying the fakes, because they're like, oh, it's as good as the original. Why would I buy the original? I'm going to show this one off because this is good.
Yeah, it's crazy.
What they are not realizing is, and this, we know this because we're in fact in the middle of a study right now, large scale study, where we have thousands and thousands of fakes, and we're actually running them through a spectrometer to understand what the hazardous substances are that it's made of, right? In different parts. We care about this because that's our job, but I'm also just interested to understand what is the actual numerical impact.
Yeah.
What we did, and this is because, you know, we were at a couple of events and they had all these jewelry testing things. And we were like, hey, what if we ran our fakes through, or whatever we have through those, just to see what it's like, that geeky experiment. When we ran the fakes, 100% of the fakes that we ran, all of them had lead and cadmium on their surface, shoes, bags, etc. So if someone's buying these things, they don't realize that they're rubbing lead paint on themselves every day.
Yeah,
that is by definition a dangerous proposition and a health hazard.
Yeah.
Now to the second level, the bigger impact is also on the local societies, because what ends up happening is it creates perverse incentives for people to import and sell counterfeit goods, which are completely off the books. Right. You don't pay taxes on counterfeit products. You don't know what they're made of, where they're made, and they're typically, we've been to some of these places, and they're not made in the most hygienic or the most, you know, they don't have an OSHA poster up in their offices. And in many cases, they're made by, you know, the people who shouldn't be occupied, child labor, for example, and they directly, there is documented evidence of them directly funding criminal organizations and as well terrorist organizations. ISIS is a good example. So the impact is massive. And when people buy counterfeit goods, they think it's victimless, but there are two levels of victims here, one of them being themselves.
Interesting. Interesting. As we're slowly wrapping up here, just from your point of view of being in the industry, for the listeners who are out there have maybe visited like New York, for example, I mean, you can go on a Sunday afternoon and you can see them on the street corners. Where are people sourcing? Like, it's crazy how filled it is. Like in the US, for example, like where are these sourcing areas? If you can share.
So it's completely overseas, but it's not just one place that everybody's mind goes to.
Yeah.
When you think of fakes, it's a lot of places that you would not imagine where fakes come from. Switzerland, Italy, parts of other parts of Europe, some parts of the Middle East, and of course parts of Asia as well. And it keeps changing. The we cannot look at counterfeits as some guy, some Joe in his garage sitting and doing this stuff.
Yeah.
It is basically the upside down world where the logistics are excellent. The distribution networks are fantastic. They know what they're doing and they know how to get product from one place to another. And with manufacturing, they're getting better and better every day. The artisanship, the workmanship, etc. So it's not coming from only one source. And if people go out looking for them, it's not very hard to find them. And nowadays, it's even easier for a consumer to source because of social media and all of these things. But I wouldn't just blame social media. It's a multi-pronged problem. Internet, just as a whole, is the best distribution source.
Yep, for sure. Well, as we wrap up the episode here, if you can share one piece of advice with an aspiring entrepreneur, something you've learned or regret along the way, what would that be?
Oh, God. I mean, I'm probably the least qualified to be sharing this because, like I said before, I didn't even want a job. And I've listened to some of your episodes and they're amazing, amazingly talented people on there. but it's the landscape for when we started building versus now is, or at least a year or two ago, very different in terms of founder mentality, et cetera. But I feel like it's coming full circle now, you know, what growth looks like, what learning looks like. I would say there's a few things that are completely worthwhile to think hard on. But outside of that, bias yourself towards action. But the things I would think hard on if I was building this again is, one, is the timing correct? Is this relevant as whatever you're building right now? Why is it relevant? Timing always matters, right? In our case, it was the confluence of internet, AI, SaaS. So in any case, the context of that relevance matters. Second is, do you need external cash? Can you run this yourself? If you do, and both have very different connotations in how you will build it, what approach you take. Outside of that, the only top level thing I would say is, at the outset and at very deliberate check-in points, always check in with your partners and your co-founders, if you're building it with other people, to have 100% alignment in what you're building. Because if you're not aligned at the top, nothing that flows down further from there is going to ever be effective or useful.
Yep. Love it. Well, what you guys are building is an extremely comprehensive but user-friendly solution towards a massive problem. So, yeah, Vidyu, thank you so much for joining me today. And to the listeners out there, make sure to check out Entropy at entropy.com. Hey, thank you for listening to this episode of Starting Small. If you would, leave a review on whatever platform you're listening on. Also, follow Starting Small on social platforms and make sure to subscribe to our email so you don't miss anything on Starting Small Summit, more podcast episodes, or our online blog. You can find that link in this description.